Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day after the State of the Union Address. And that is our focus, the first hour of our program.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills. And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well. Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership. We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
Joining us in our Milwaukee studios to talk about the President's State of the Union Address, Mike Ushay, Distinguished Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University, host of Upfront with Mike Ushay on WISN television here in town, and longtime anchor for news at WTMJ in Milwaukee. Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm.
Also joining us in our studios is Professor Julia Azari, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She is a presidential scholar, and we thank you very much for joining us in our studio. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
We already got phone calls coming in. Oh, you're such a good audience. You're so involved. We'll be taking your phone calls in a little while. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The president started his address with some talk about the accomplishments that he has made during the course of the past year. I found it interesting because you don't hear very much of that rhetoric. Nobody is touting what has happened that has been good. Did he make a case for achieving anything that was significant in the last year, Mike?
I think he certainly tried to make the case. I thought he was forceful last night. I thought he did his best to defend the decisions that he's made, namely the stimulus spending. I thought he tried to defend the how that has played out, and I thought he made a case again for health care, revisited it, although fairly far into the speech, I might add. And I think he tried to underscore the fact that while he had not certainly been perfect in terms of his first year in office and his administration had made some mistakes, that they did understand that people wanted a change in the way business was done in Washington. So I think he tried to make the case that it has been a productive first year, and that it was not a year that he could afford to not take on the many challenges facing the country.
Mm-hmm. Was it a productive first year, Professor Azari?
It was. It was a productive first year. And I think one of the important things that Obama made the case for was the idea that his government took action to keep the economy from getting worse. He had to make the case that looking back over his first year in office, voters shouldn't expect miraculous changes. They should expect to see potentially incremental change, responding to criticisms that the administration is going too fast. I think that trying to make that point that things should go a little bit slower was really crucial for Obama to do, and I think that he did a good job of that.
I remember him saying a year ago that we could judge the success of his first year if there were 4 million jobs either saved or 4 million jobs created. He talked about the number of jobs, 2 million jobs created, 200,000 jobs for new energy, 300,000 for first responders, etc. There is a huge cry right now from a number of people because the unemployment rate is so large and so many people are hurting. People on the left of the party are saying, you need a massive jobs bill. You need to get people back to work. Forget about the deficit. Let's get people working in this country. Did he, in the jobs part of the speech, make a case for getting people back to work? Was there a lot of meat there?
There's some meat there. I think that there are probably even some Republicans, although I'm not sure how this will play out legislatively, but I think there are some Republicans who would probably agree with a number of his proposals, which are designed, I think it's safe to say, mostly to benefit small businesses. So I think there was some meat in terms of the job proposal. He does face a problem, though. I mean, the administration's projections of what employment would be and where we are today do not match up well. They thought we would not be at 10% unemployment nationally, and we are. I think it was also interesting to last night to hear his language when he talked about the effects of the stimulus spending, the Recovery Act, the 2 million number instead of the 4 million number.
Right.
And the 2 million, if you noticed, it was talking about jobs saved. And there was not a lot of discussion about jobs created. It was more about the firefighter who kept his job or the police officer who kept his or her job. So I think there was within the proposal, within the discussion of jobs, there was an acknowledgement more needs to be done. Here are some proposals that might have a chance of moving forward and helping the economy. But I think also if you read between the lines, there was a concession that perhaps we aren't where we thought we would be just a year ago.
What about that proposal? And there were some stirring on the part of the Republicans who obviously didn't like this idea of taking $30 billion from the money that the banks have already paid back for community banks to be lending money to stimulate jobs. Is that a big proposal? And can you imagine that that's going to happen, Professor Azari?
I can imagine that it might happen. It has potential bipartisan appeal, and that's going to be really important right now. It also fits this populist tone that the administration is trying to take and this reform tone. And in that sense, it is a big deal. I think one of the main goals that Obama needed to achieve with this speech was not only to demonstrate concrete effects in the economy, but to demonstrate that the reform promises from the campaign haven't been left by the wayside now that they're in office. And this has tones of that, tones of removing that collusion between, this perceived collusion anyway, between big government and big business and helping out the little guy. So in that sense, I think it's a program that has the potential to pass, has the potential to appeal widely in Congress and to the people, and the potential to change the tone of government to fit this idea change that Obama seems to want to bring about.
With an unemployment rate at 10%, which is really huge, there have been many who have been calling for a return to the New Deal, or some kind of massive public works program, Civilian Conservation Corps, et cetera. There have been a lot of economists who have been calling for the president to do just that. Did we get any sense of that last night? And did we get a sense that that unemployment rate in the years ahead for his administration will go way below 10%?
I don't know if I got a sense from where unemployment is headed. All I can say is that economists I've talked to about this subject are almost unanimous in saying that it is going to be very slow in terms of job growth and that the unemployment rate will come down very slowly. I don't think that's something you really necessarily want to say in a State of the Union speech, because I think you do. And one of the goals last night, I think, was to sort of try and recapture that theme of hope and change. And you have to be a little careful if you're going to tell people, look, we know it's going to be a long, difficult slog. So I'm not sure about that. It was interesting to hear him try to make the case last night that things will get better and that he is optimistic about the future.
Mm-hmm. What in the world has happened to health care?
What?
Where to start?
What?
Have we been talking about health care?
For about a year.
I think this is where, and this speaks to your point, Kathleen, about the question of are we going to see some New Deal-looking programs. I think that the Obama administration has to make a decision about whether they want to rule according to the party base, whether they want to play to the base, they want to follow the script of the Bush administration, which was successful in winning a second term, certainly, or whether they want to follow a more centrist, more national kind of plan. And
right.
That's what I heard last night as I heard Obama trying to make those kinds of overtures, mixed in with some jabs to the Republicans, But, you know, I think that that's the decision that they're going to have to make. Are they going to push health care and push it like Democrats, or are they going to do this, again, like I said before, incrementally? Are they going to push the populist line? Are they going to fall back on populist rhetoric, on reform rhetoric, good government framing and policies? That's really the question that I think they have to answer before we have any idea where we're going to go on health care.
I was striking, though, how far into the speech was before he talked about health care. I think one of the pundits last night said it was 31 minutes before the words health care were uttered. And it's not actually health care. It's health insurance reform now.
Oh, it is.
It's not health care reform. It's health insurance reform is the way it's referred to.
Thank you, Mike.
Again, it's all in the messaging, and but I was just really struck by that. I mean, as he said, I'm not walking away from it, but I don't think anybody knows where they're walking to. There is just no consensus in Washington on where they should go next, and I'll be very interested to see how that plays out and what kind of priority it remains.
Can somebody explain to me, because I don't fully understand this. Maybe I don't understand the rules here or how the something can be done considering what the rules are. The president made reference to this supermajority. This 60-vote thing is all over the place. There's not any major legislation because of the 60 votes. It has resulted in a lot of gridlock here. There's just not a whole lot, I don't think, going on in the last year. And most people did want some kind of health care reform. Why do we have this 60 vote? Is there a way to change that? Do you think that he will use healthcare reform incrementally and deal with things that can be done by reconciliation and skip the 60 vote? What's going on with the 60 votes?
Well, the 60 vote majority, it has been the requirement, or the, excuse me, the 60 vote supermajority has been the requirement to invoke what's called cloture in the Senate. In the mid-70s, that was changed. It used to actually be two-thirds. But in addition to the change in formal Senate procedure, they made it easier to invoke cloture. But at the same time, this filibuster idea, this is an old Senate tradition, has become the norm. And that's what's changed over the last couple of decades. Now, major legislation can almost expect to face what some congressional scholars call extended debate, where cloture has to be invoked. You have to have 60 people on board for things to go forward. And that's kind of a combination of the formal rules and informal practice. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that the default is 60 votes. So that's the kind of quick and dirty spiel about how the filibuster works.
Mm-hmm. So do you imagine then in the next few years there will be a different way to try to get things through?
Well, there's the budget reconciliation process, and there are rules that govern what kind of legislation can be introduced under reconciliation. Under budget reconciliation, the Senate, they can't filibuster. It's a straight-up majority rule, but it has to relate to budgetary issues. That's typically how Congress has accomplished major legislation over the last couple of decades. That's how they get major bills through, and committees then have to coordinate in order to come out with a budget that makes sense, where the numbers meet up.
Mm-hmm. Mike, you've been covering politics for a long time, although you're a much younger person than I am, but you have been covering it for a long time. Can you remember a time when we had such incredible partisanship, you know, where one party is called the party of no, and indeed they're together on all these issues? Has there been a time when the Democrats were the party of no? It just seems so bad.
I think it feels that way, and I'm beginning to think it feels that way every time we have a new president.
Mm.
I just think our world has changed. The way we access information, the explosion of the blogosphere, I just think there's a different feel to the way politics is practiced. I'm not naive about our history, and we've always had parties that disagree and philosophically can be very blunt in the statement of their differences. But I think it's because of the changing media world to some extent that you see the hyper-partisan rhetoric. And I don't know, is it a good thing or a bad thing? You can make the argument it's good to have more Democratic voices out there. People have a chance to participate, and that's probably a fair argument. But I'm not sure that it's necessarily good in the long run for the country to view everything. And I thought, and I'll attribute it to what the president said last night, every day is election day in Washington. And I'm not sure that is the best thing long term for the country. And I do think politics is practiced that way, and by both parties. Mm-hmm. Neither party is innocent in this.
Give us a historical perspective on this, Professor Azari. Are we at a time of intense never seen before partisanship?
I wouldn't call it never seen before, but I think we're at a period of intense partisanship that's pretty new for the last couple of decades. We're in a different place than we were. Specifically, I think we're in a different place than where we were, if we want to think back to the Great Society, thinking back to the Lyndon Johnson administration in the mid-60s, civil rights, those kinds of major reforms. Those were bipartisan reforms. Those were reforms in which it was possible to reach across the aisle, and there was some degree of consensus about, if not what the solutions were, what the problems were. And what I'm seeing in our discourse right now about politics is not just a disagreement about how to solve problems, but a fundamental disagreement about what the issues are. And you saw this, if anyone caught the brief rebuttal, Chris McDonald, governor of Virginia, mentioned something when he was talking about health care, said, we don't want to see the best health care system in the world taken over by the government.
Yes.
And that reflects essentially a perspective that says there isn't a lot wrong with health care. And obviously the Democrats disagree. And when you disagree about what's wrong, that makes it very difficult to move forward with anything resembling a solution.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got the progressives saying, where the heck is the government in health care reform? There's not enough mm-hmm. of it.
Exactly.
Unusual times. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are all filled. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you are welcome to do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We're talking this hour about the State of the Union Address. Our guests are Professor Julia Azari, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, a presidential scholar she is, and Mike Goucher, Distinguished Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University, host of Upfront with Mike Goucher on WISN. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Bill calling from McGregor, Iowa. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I'm enjoying your program, and I enjoyed the speech last night so much. I wanted to say that I think, as a country, we're so fortunate to have a fresh, young president with intelligence, good ideas, sincerity. I honestly think he has the good of the country in mind, and he is very clever at doing it. And I'm embarrassed. I'm a former Republican. I'm so embarrassed at the negativism. They're not. How could they not break ranks? Not one person. It's like a new person being put into a football game where they attack that position. It's just very unfortunate. How can our country, how can we move ahead and attack and go for the problems if we can't cooperate with each other? That's my comment.
Thank you, Bill. It's a valid comment.
Yeah, I think Bill's identified the issue right there, that we want the president to communicate with us as if he has the best interests of the country in mind. And that can sometimes be at odds with some of the goals the president might have trying to lead the party. I think that Obama's still navigating that, but I think that that's absolutely the question.
And it is interesting to not have one. He thought he had Olympia Snow. He didn't have Olympia Snow. There isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about, Mike?
Well, I think part of it is policy, part of it is politics. I've talked to a number of Republicans about this. I talked to Congressman Paul Ryan from southeastern Wisconsin, who's considered something of a young ideas person in the Republican Party. And in the beginning of the health care discussion, he put forward some ideas, and he said, you know, they're just not interested. The Democrats are not interested in my ideas. The contention of Republicans is that we were not welcomed into this process, that the Democrats knew they had come off an election that gave them an awful lot of clout in Washington. They were going to do it their way, and Republicans felt removed from the process. Now I think the political part of it has entered in, and I think now there is the perception on the part of a number of Republicans that the president is on the ropes somewhat. And now it has become much more political, and now we're in the midterm elections cycle. And I think they're looking at it now to some extent as a political issue. Yes, it's a policy issue. There are fundamental disagreements on what we should do with health care or health insurance reform in this country. But politically, you cannot deny that that is a part of what's happening right now. So I think there are a variety of factors that have entered into where we are today. And probably a fair amount of blame to place on all sides.
Mm-hmm. Are they tasting victory, do you think, in midterm elections? We're seeing a lot of Scott, you know, Senator, who will soon be the senator from Massachusetts. We're hearing a lot about him. We're even hearing talk that maybe he's the next presidential candidate, up and rising star. The rebuttal that was given last night by McDonnell from Virginia, who's only been in office for about 12 days, another young, perhaps rising star for the party. Is that what is happening here, that politics is really front and center, so skip the other things?
I think so. But this is also part of a pretty normal process. It's unusual to see a new president from a new party come in and see that president bring in members of Congress with him and have an overwhelming majority and not see a midterm loss. In some cases, a pretty devastating midterm loss. If you think back to 1982, it's about, I believe, 26, 28 seats lost in the House by the Republicans in 1982. And Ronald Reagan is still considered a pretty successful president in a lot of circles. So it isn't necessarily devastating, and it would be almost unnatural, according to the laws of our politics, seeming laws, these trends, if that were not to happen. But I think it's also evidence of a problem that's a little bit deeper, and that's that there seems to be a tendency right now for the electorate to blame individuals for systemic problems, to blame the Democrats now for not having fixed problems, when 2 years ago, 4 years ago, they were blaming the Republicans for having not fixed essentially the same problems. You can't keep forever turning out the incumbents and not give anyone a chance to do anything. I'm not saying we shouldn't hold our elected officials accountable, but the problems may transcend the individuals who are occupying a particular seat.
Let's go next. Thanks, Bill, for your call. Bob is next from Stevens Point. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
I am not a professional lip reader, but if I remember right, Judge Alioto, although it was, he actually almost not voted in because the Democrats were practicing cloture.
Don't
you remember the big compromise between Byrd and Ed to get 60 votes for him? So, in effect, the Democrats were doing, because, in effect, all the president is doing when he wants compromise, he's just talking to the Republicans. I watched the hearings in both houses, and I saw vote after vote turned out down by the Democrat majority. Anything that the House or the senator would bring up was rejected.
That is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. The Democrats during the last administration did threaten to filibuster judicial nominees, filibustered judicial nominees, not Supreme Court nominees. Alito was actually confirmed with a narrow margin. I want to say 52 votes, if anyone can remember. That wasn't a filibuster case, but that's absolutely true that the Democrats are just as guilty of this.
What was going on with Alito? First of all, let's talk about the, which I thought was unusual, the president pointing to the Supreme Court decision on campaign finance reform, and to see these justices who were supposed to be impartial just all sitting there with faces that didn't show anything. First of all, for the president to say something about their decision, which I thought was interesting and pretty vociferously, and then the response of Alito, I believe it was, who many commentators were saying was mouthing something, not out loud, but quietly.
Well, it was fascinating. I was watching a speech last night in the newsroom, and I, at first, when I heard the president begin with all due deference, and then proceeded to pass judgment, and at least his judgment on the recent Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance. But anyhow, and then to see, and this did catch my eye, and I noticed it caught the eye of a lot of folks, to see Justice Alito shaking his head, and the words that I thought he said at the time was, "That's not true." And I thought that was an interesting, a visible response on the part of a justice. The whole situation, I want to say, surprised me. I was surprised to see the president raise it in the way he raised it, and I was surprised to see the reaction of the justice.
Hmm. Were you?
I was surprised to see the reaction, certainly. That's not what we normally see from members of the Supreme Court. Although, in defense of Alito, It's not clear that what Obama was saying, he was specifically, the comment was that foreign corporations would be able to donate money in candidate elections. It's not clear that that's true. It may be that there's a legal loophole. They haven't, it seems they haven't quite worked that out yet. Nevertheless, whether it was appropriate for Alito to do that in public is another matter entirely. But I wasn't surprised to see the president bring it up. It really fit with this good government tone of the speech. He talked a lot about reform, and he talked a lot about making the government. Did anyone else catch the line about a government as decent as its people, or
right.
a government that matches
sure.
the decency? Did anyone else hear Jimmy Carter there? A government as good as its people. I think Obama's trying. I don't know why he's taking a speechwriting lesson from Jimmy Carter, but I think that he's trying to channel that same kind of energy. And that's a way maybe to transcend some of the partisan questions. And so in that sense, I wasn't at all surprised to hear him attack that decision in a kind of reformist, populist tone.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob, for your call. We go next to Mike from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Kathleen, and to the guests. I guess I was a little disappointed with his sense of urgency. I'm kind of a policy wonk, and I was desperately hoping that the Conrad Gregg Reform Commission was going to pass, but McConnell and Senator Baucus killed it on the floor of the Senate. Anyhow, he mentioned that he was going to suggest a commission, but unfortunately the commission that he's suggesting is just one with no teeth to it. We've got this $70 trillion obligated debt, and we frankly have to address it, or the country's essentially going to collapse economically. And now that he doesn't have his 60 votes, this commission really amounts to nothing, because you can attach amendments to it. Democrats are going to try to, you know, resist any entitlement reforms. Republicans are going to resist any tax increases. So essentially, it has no teeth at all. So I was really disappointed in that.
Well, and I thought about it when he announced it. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, another commission. How many commissions have we had on this particular issue? Tons of them.
I think we know what the problems are. I think we know that we're on this route to serious financial ruin, really, for this nation. But knowing that and doing something about it are two very different things. And I think just the reaction to the mere proposal of a commission mm-hmm. demonstrated how difficult it's going to be to tackle mm-hmm. any discussion of the entitlement programs in this country. I don't know where that heads. It'll be very interesting. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to deal with things when they reach the crisis stage. But if it isn't a crisis already, it's very close to being one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very cheap way to try and give the appearance of transparency
right.
and
true.
Accountability.
True. Thank you very much. The thing that was creating a bit of controversy before this speech, and I'm wondering how controversial this will become, was the call for spending freeze when he talked about this will take place in 2011, and he got some snickers from some people in the audience concerning that when he was telling people, you know, what spending freezes were. And I'm wondering what you think about that and the kind of impact that it will have, why he decided to go that route. He's keeping the military intact and all the entitlement programs we were just talking about as well. But he was very methodical. I'm going to go through this item by item by item by item, and we will cut what is not necessary. Is that a good idea in a recession? Is that something that will be controversial? Is that something that will work?
Yeah, that's the subject for debate. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Kathleen. The president is taking a lot of lumps from the left. People who are accusing him of repeating history and leading us down the road of from Hoover to FDR in 1937. And that you have to grow the economy. The argument is you have to spend to push our way out of a recession, and we're not far enough out of that recession yet, and there's a danger of falling back into it if we don't spend. I was struck by the language used when he proposed this three-year discretionary spending freeze from people who supported him and were strong advocates of his. I think Paul Krugman called it appalling. Rachel Maddow referred to it as insane, completely insane. I think Chris Hayes from The Nation said, if we could sue for political malpractice against the president and congressional Democrats, we would. They are very unhappy about this. They think it's exactly the wrong prescription for where we are. Having said that, he's listening to what the public is saying. And the public is saying, we're not comfortable with the levels of spending. We're just not comfortable with that. So in his attempt, I think, to respond, He's alienated his base, which is not a good thing for the Democratic Party in a midterm election year. But he's not necessarily winning over Republicans who still claim we're not dealing with the serious issues. We're not dealing with entitlements. We're dealing with the easy stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting situation he finds himself in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that it's the policy equivalent of the commission. It's a relatively easy, cheap sort of way to address issues. It's political. It's an attempt to play to the center, but maybe not very effectively, and it's not going to deal with any of the difficult questions. It's not systemic. It's not going to change the patterns of spending and why those patterns occur. It's going to freeze for a given period, and it's not even really clear mm-hmm. what the goals are.
Hmm. We have a couple lines open now, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the presidential speech, the State of the Union address last night, and we go to Dan from Cross Plains. Hi, Dan.
Hi. A couple things that were missing for me last night. I was it was unfortunate to not hear about the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, and we also didn't hear about the working poor. My cousin recently got a job at Walmart back in the dock, $7.80 an hour, and they hired him at 32 hours a week, so they didn't have to give him health care. So it's like, you know, that just flies in the face of this trickle down, you know, let the corporations get big and they'll take care of folks. So I wish that Obama would challenge that and start talking about more of a trickle up economy. And then my other comment was just about, like, with the teabagger guest you had on yesterday, there seems to be this huge push from the right that government just can't do anything. You know, despite the fact that government provides, you know, safe food, safe drugs, education, parks, highways, like really the foundation of a civilized society. And one of the interesting comments that David Brooks made on PBS last night was that the Republicans keep going after this one, but that's one thing Obama, he's not pushing back on it. And I really think we need a response.
Professor Azari, you want to start?
Yeah, I think you should run for office, the caller. It sounds like you have a good grip on the issues. And, yeah, Obama has backed off of any potential promises to change, really fundamentally change the tone of the debate in the way that Reagan was able to do in the 80s and the way that FDR was able to do back in the 30s, to really change the tone of the debate about what government should do and how we should approach problems. And instead, he gave this kind of empty line about the bank bailout. Did anyone else think that was a little bit vacuous? I hated it. We all hated it. Well, that doesn't really do anything for anybody. You know, people are still working these wage jobs. He didn't. It was, again, a kind of throwaway populist line, and it didn't really offer solutions for people who are facing these real problems. Same with the rhetoric in the beginning about going to Elkhart, Indiana, about people coaching Little League. You know, I've studied a lot of the process of speechwriting. You can almost hear the speechwriters fighting over whether or not that should be in there and Obama agreeing to it. But when he delivered it, it didn't sound like he really meant it. So there was a lot of pandering and not a lot of solid policy offerings there for, as our caller said, the working poor.
Mm-hmm. I think the caller does express some of the frustration that you'll hear from union members, people who worked very hard for the president's election and who feel that he has not done the things he would promise for them in his first year. And everybody knows he's had a lot on his plate. But you can begin to see some of his constituencies saying, what about me? What about me? Last night he tried to address that with the gays in the military issue. That right. was, you know, and that kind of goes to, I think, a little bit what we've been talking about here, that, you know, you're parceling out things in an attempt to appease certain parts of the electorate. But union folks and some working folks just feel like, well, wait a second. Why did we go door to door for you? Why did we do as much as we did if you're not going to really fight on our behalf? So I hear what he's saying on that. And I think that the president, on his other point about government, you know, the president, I think, tried to address this feeling that there's this deficit of distrust and that we don't place much faith in our institutions in this country. I think that's probably an interesting point for discussion. And I think there's probably some truth to it. We don't place a lot of faith, whether it's the media, whether it's government, whatever. And again, I would go back and say that's at least in part a product of our changing media world, our changing news cycle, all of that. Mm-hmm. So I agree. I thought the caller had some very good points. But on the jobs front, I could see why some people think,
yes,
you know, this, you're not really talking about how tough it is.
Yes.
It's worse out there than even what you're saying.
Yeah. Get in touch with what's really going on out there. What about lobbyists when you talk about deficit of trust? He talked about the outside influence of lobbyists, and he wanted people to have to keep track of every contact they had made. I didn't know if he meant, you know, if it's on the internet or where that is. But the lobbyist influence, even when you look at what happened ultimately with the health care bill, is huge in Washington, and he's probably also design policy because of the outside influence of lobbyists. Did he call for a substantial change? Can he, because he and everybody is under the influence of lobbyists, be above the fray in all of this?
I think he's trying. But any change that can actually happen is going to be incremental. And here I'll join the president in bashing the Supreme Court a little bit. Until the Supreme Court rules that money isn't speech, we're not going to be free of these influences. This money is going to rule the day, and they're going to be lobbyists and moneyed interests are going to influence the policy debates as long as the Supreme Court puts the brakes on any meaningful campaign finance reform. So whatever President Obama said, really any kind of solutions, even solutions that sound sweeping to look back a couple of years to the McCain-Feingold bill that's now been dismantled a little bit, even that really is incremental relative to the kinds of campaign finance limitations we see in other advanced industrial democracies.
Mm-hmm. Mike, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that's a you know, that's another one of those points that people sitting at home say, yeah, that's right. Lobbyists have too much impact. But it's the reality of Washington. And I think if you notice when the president even raised his point last night, that there was a little audience reaction to
mm-hmm.
it. It was like, oh,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you're being disingenuous, Mr. President.
All right.
And it's hard to say that you're going to be the agent of change when the people in your administration, many of whom have strong Wall Street ties, there becomes a mixed message. And so it sounds good to take a shot at the lobbyists and to call for greater transparency. But I think to the average voter, they say, well, what really did change? Who's making the decisions in the administration? Who has the president's ear? I think that's a tough sell, I think, for the president. And I think the reaction on the part of some in the Capitol last night reflected that, yeah, that sounds great, but.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It brings up the question. I think Bob Herbert had this in a column earlier this week of who is he? Is he somebody who's on the side of the working poor, the middle class? Is he a populist? Is he concerned about the influence of lobbyists? Because he uses them as well. So does it call into question what his philosophy is, where he's guiding us, what kind of leader he is, or not? Is that taking it too far?
No, I think it absolutely does. And I think that's the big question with this president that we still haven't answered is who is he? What does he stand for? And like you said, how much of his economic alliances are really with the poor and the middle class? And how much is just, like our previous caller was saying, politics as usual vis-a-vis the divisions, the great economic inequalities that exist? And I still don't think we have the answer to that question.
Hmm. Do you think we know who he is, Mike?
I don't think so. And I'm not sure we would know completely in 1 year. I think we've gotten glimpses of who he is, what he believes. But I'm not one of those. I think we do pass judgment a little too quickly on our presidents. And there's a lot of history here to suggest that we need to take a deep breath and say, let's see what happens. You know, I think it was Paul Begala last night said that after Bill Clinton had been in office 13 days, one pundit wrote that the presidency was over for Bill Clinton. It was over after 13 days. Now, this is a year, but you know. It's
just a year.
It's a four-year term.
Right. You know? More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the State of the Union address And our guests are Mike Uchet, Distinguished Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University, host of Upfront with Mike Uchet on WISN Television here in Milwaukee, Professor Julia Azari, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She is a Presidential Scholar. The number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And after 2 years of recession, the economy is growing again. Retirement funds have started to gain back some of their value. Businesses are beginning to invest again. And slowly, some are starting to hire again. But I realize that for every success story, there are other stories of men and women who wake up with the anguish of not knowing where their next paycheck will come from, who send out resumes week after week and hear nothing in response. That is why jobs must be our number one focus in 2010, and that's why I'm calling for a new jobs bill tonight.
State of the Union address, when he talked about things are getting better, are things getting a little better? When he talks about the economy is not moving as fast as it should, but there are signs of recovery, it's not as stagnant as it was a year ago. Do we have signs that Wall Street is a little bit more stable than it was? Do we have signs that things are a little better?
I think it's not so much an argument. I think things are better. If you think back to where we were a year ago, we had come off an episode in our history where many people, and from both parties, will tell you that we were at the precipice, where we faced the financial collapse of you know, perhaps this country and other countries around the world. And I had people tell me that in no uncertain terms, that was the information they were presented. So we came off a very, very difficult stretch for this country. I think in the last year, you've seen the rate of job loss drop considerably. We're not seeing much in the way of job growth right now, but it has. That trend has moved in the right direction. I think you're starting to see some evidence that housing has stabilized. You see the number, it's fits and starts, really. You see some things that are more optimistic, then you see a step back. And I think that's the big issue, Kathleen, that whether or not, I think the numbers suggest, yes, a recovery is underway. Most economists say, yes, a recovery is underway. But it doesn't really feel much like a recovery to the typical folks out there,
right,
who are still struggling to make their mortgage payment, who are worried about their jobs, who may be working in a part-time job at Walmart on a loading dock,
right,
but they really want a full-time job. There are a lot of those things. Economy is better than it was a year ago, but for a lot of people it doesn't feel that way.
Do you agree, Professor Azar?
I agree that the indicators seem to suggest that we're at the beginning of a recovery. It's interesting to note that typically people don't base their voting choice, are they going to throw the incumbent out of office or not, on their own personal economic situation. They tend to base it on their sense of the economy overall. Which is kind of a puzzling thing, yet it seems to be true. But there's a possibility that's shifting. So I think it'll be really interesting to look at how people make their vote choices in 2010, and how people say that they make their vote choices in 2010, and what the political reaction will be if the economy still hasn't had a massive rebound at that point, which it probably won't. I think it's also important to note that politically this goes back again to some of the major policy questions, including regulatory reform. And politically, there's going to be at least a group in the Democratic Party base who won't really see the problem as resolved until the regulatory structure changes, and until the rules are, to put it in this populist political speech, the rules are the same for Wall Street and Main Street. And whether that's something we're going to see, whether we're going to see meaningful change, meaningful banking and financial reform, is yet to be seen. Congress has been working on it, but it's been overshadowed largely, of course, by health care. And then there's the question of whether Ben Bernanke will be reconfirmed by the Senate. And the question of whether Timothy Geithner needs to go. Those questions really are going to be, I think, crucial, especially in elite political circles, for how whatever economic recovery occurs is received.
Yeah. You mentioned Wall Street. I think Wall Street right now is fairly ambivalent about this president because On the one hand, we had quite a run-up over the last 6 months in terms of, as the president mentioned last night, people's retirement accounts have seen some better days in the last 6 months after terrible days for the preceding year. And it seemed like things were moving in the right direction in terms of Wall Street's vision of the future. But now we've had, I think, with the language about the bankers, with the greater and greater talk of financial reform, Wall Street is a little skeptical of where the president is going. And we'll see how that plays into the economy. Again, that gives people that sense of their personal well-being.
Right.
If you're looking at that 401 statement and you want to cry, you don't feel good about things. If it's growing, you feel a little differently. So, but I think Wall Street's very, very mixed right now. Not happy, certainly, with certain aspects of what the president is saying.
And we're not very happy with many of them, too. Rightfully so. I mean, they took our money and ran. Tom from – where are you from, Tom?
I'm in the Boston area.
Okay. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My comment here pertains to the health care program, of which it only seems like the Democrats are take any kind of issue to it. The last time it was brought up and voted down was the Clinton era. Republicans have not came up with any ideas of their own. So just to say this is all Obama, I think is leaves a bad taste in my mouth, because the Republicans are against it. They're going to be against whatever anybody comes up for it.
Well, he did have a legitimate point when he challenged them last night. If you've got an idea, put it on my desk. Come talk to me.
As long as it met about four different Democratic criteria. Then put it on my desk, as long as you agree to
it's
this.
It's just hard to imagine a bipartisan debate on this, or these people getting together and in the interest of the American people coming up with something that would be good for all of us. It just seems like we're beyond that, which is too bad.
The Democrats really dropped the ball over the summer, letting the Republicans frame the debate. And so we started out the debate not even with a debate about cost, but about death panels and about abortion. And so you've already set a precedent where there's really no common ground, where there's deeply felt moral convictions, where there is hard to compromise. So where do you go from there? And the Democrats simply let, and I shouldn't even say the Republicans, they let characters in the Republican Party like Sarah Palin run the debate, who really don't have an interest in a successful Congress, but who have an interest in their own political careers or their own careers as as pundits and their own ratings.
You know, Democrats can blame Republicans for why health care hasn't passed, but they need to look in the mirror. They really do. I mean, they really have no one to blame but themselves for not being able to get it done. And in many respects, they're being held hostage by members of their own party. I mean, if Democrats, just using big D, if Democrats wanted to pass a health insurance reform measure, they could right now. There is the Senate measure. But members of the House say, we don't agree with that. We're not happy with that. So, you know, you can blame Republicans and say, well, they haven't, you know, been playing nicely. But Democrats had an opportunity, and now that opportunity has passed. And so, you know, they had a lot of time that they look back on and say, we may have wasted that time.
Thanks, Tom. Robert from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi there. Yeah, the question is, I mean, how can a Democratic president be successful when the number two personality out there is Glenn Beck in a recent poll on TV, when it's quite obvious to me that a conservative truly believes in pure capitalism, but it's a platform you can't win on because there's big losers and big winners. So they constantly attack at Democrats' motives, and they do it every day on the radio. They do it all day on Fox. They paint them as ungodly, that they hate their country, and they want to take your money. And they do it every day, and it trickles through the cracks to the common people, and that message has such movement. How can you possibly be successful?
Professor, sorry. Let me start.
Well, that's a good question, and it's not a question with a simple answer. But in terms of the thinking about the relative advantages the president has over other people in the political system to try and be successful, to try and affect change, to try and influence the way people are thinking on Main Street, to keep borrowing this populist language, you know, there are a few things the president can do to try and rhetorically match the incredible power of these personalities, like Glenn Beck. And one of those things is to call on people to actually behave like citizens, not like partisans, and not like passive consumers of mass media, but to not just for the president to think about the good of the country, but the president can actually call on other people to be active citizens, right, to be more involved. If you don't like what's going on in your government, then come and be involved. And in that sense, I think the president could do more to control the message. The speech last night, I didn't think really called on people to be more active, to be citizens, to take their country's future into their own hands. And that really, you know, that would have been a more powerful message, that sitting back and watching the government fight about health care, sitting back and watching other people control the message, that's not really inviting people to be part of things, inviting solutions. So I think that the president can do more there. The president can try and compete with some of these messages that you talk about.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. We could go all day. I wish we could.
Great to be with
Thank
you.
Thank you. Yeah, great to have you here. Our thanks to Professor Julia Azari, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, a Presidential Scholar, and Mike Ushay, Distinguished Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette, host of Upfront with Mike Ushay on WISN Television. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. Second hour of our show, That Crumpled Paper, was due last week, helping disorganized and distracted boys succeed in school and life. This is the Ideas Network.